KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for joining me today on an inaugural show for Hearsay Culture as we begin the fall quarter of KZSU's schedule. And today I'm very excited to have on the authors of the book Blown to Bits, Your Life, Liberty, and Happiness After the Digital Explosion, published by Addison Wesley. The authors are Hal Abelson, Ken Ledeen, and Harry Lewis, and I'm going to get into their backgrounds and, in fact, allow them to discuss their backgrounds in more detail shortly. But for those of you that listen regularly to Hearsay Culture, you know that we discuss various aspects of technology with a lot of the guests that we have on the show, whether they be aspects dealing with intellectual property or privacy or reputation or how technology works or what's happening with the internet, what value should be there, and so forth. We've also had technology historians, people that are looking at the history of science and trying to find patterns, books that deal with questions of innovation and how innovation is encouraged and how it's developed within technology. And today, we're really going to have a very wide-ranging discussion because the book Blown to Bits covers an immense amount of ground in a relatively short amount of time. I was very excited and am very excited to have these authors on the show because the book itself, I think, is highly readable and highly valuable to both experts and lay people. In fact, it's the kind of book that I think if I were to teach a cyber law course down the road, I might very well, in fact, would, I think, assign this book as a primer to my students to basically get them up to speed on a lot of the issues going on and then going forward from there. But I think the book is also valuable to those who want to think about these issues in a holistic way. It's interesting to note that the book itself, when you look at the endorsements, you don't see a lot of books that have the endorsement of both Tom Ridge and Larry Lessig. So I think that says something about the book as well. The book Blown to Bits covers a variety of areas, and obviously the subtitle, Your Life, Liberty, and Happiness After the Digital Explosion, suggests the kinds of issues that the authors are focusing on. And today we're going to be discussing quite a few of these issues, although, of course, like any show, we can't quite cover nearly as much as we'd like, even in the 50-minute period. So by way of very brief background, Hal Abelson is the class of 1922 professor of computer science and engineering at MIT, as well as an IEEE fellow. He's helped drive innovative technology initiatives such as the open courseware. He's a co-founder of Creative Commons and Public Knowledge, and also was founding director of the Free Software Foundation. Ken Ledeen is chairman and CEO of Nevo Technologies and has served on the board of numerous technology companies. Harry Lewis is a former dean of Harvard College, is a Gordon McKay Professor of Computer Science at Harvard. He's also the author of the book Excellence Without a Soul, Does Liberal Education Have a Future? And interestingly, and it's something we're going to discuss, the authors also co-teach a course, which we'll dive into a bit. So, without any further introduction, gentlemen, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you for having me here.
Let's start off. I mentioned very briefly your backgrounds, but I think it's valuable for the listeners to discuss those in a little more detail. So I'll kind of ask each of you your background and how you got into focusing on computers and your interest in technology generally.
Well, I guess I'll start. This is Harry. I got interested in computers when I was when I was in high school back in the mid '60s. And Ken, my co-author here, and I actually worked in the same computer-based laboratory at Harvard when we were undergraduates. He was a class ahead of me, so he was the smart guy who actually knew all this stuff about computers, and I was learning from him at that time. And I just got into the field and became a professor of computer science and have been on the faculty at Harvard since the mid-70s. So that's my background. Ken, why don't you say a little more about yours? Ken's the only one of the three of us who knows how to make an honest living in the real world.
Right, so I'm the non-academic. This is Ken Ledeen. I'm the non-academic in the group. And actually, back in the really the early 60s, 1964, I was faced with earning money, and I realized that I could earn a dollar an hour washing dishes or $6 an hour as a computer programmer. And being a perceptive young man, I decided that the latter was a much better choice, and have basically been doing this ever since then. And as we talk about the characteristics of the digital explosion, both Harry Hall and I have had the enormous benefit of really being able to be witnesses to this explosion since its very early times. It's been a remarkable ride and a great opportunity to see how things progress. So for my part, I've been in this business for the last 40 years running a company that does software development.
This is Hal Abelson. I've been working with computers, I guess, since I was in high school. I had a job at a local airbase, being one of the people first playing around with these funny machines. I think I no longer remember how to read punch paper tape just by eye, but I did do that sort of thing. When I became an undergraduate, I worked in the computer center helping retrained physicists from this ancient language called Fortran to the language of the future, which everyone knew was PL1. So you might consider that Fortran is still around and PL1 is not, and then got a job as one of the radicals who was encouraging the computer center to waste computer time by doing this useless thing called time sharing, when everyone knew that the real purpose of computers was to do batch processing and solving differential equations.
And it's fascinating always when I hear about different computer languages to try to think if I ever, sitting at my Commodore 64, attempted to dabble in those languages. And I think I have a vague recollection of messing around with Fortran. Let's again, by way of background, before we get into some of the details and the issues you discuss in the book, you've come together as authors to write this book. And perhaps I'll ask you why. What brought you together or made you think that this was a book worth writing?
Well, the book. Here's the way the book happened. The book happened as a corollary to a course, and the course happened because about four or five years ago, I made a certain career change, got out of university administration, back into full time teaching, and you know, suddenly kind of looking at the world as it was in the early 2000s. I just saw that the impact of the fact that information was everywhere now, bits, the zeros and ones, which is just our, you know, way of our shorthand for digital information, it was now everybody was saving everything, and the world, the entire world, had gone so digital that ordinary citizens, whatever their walks of lives, needed to understand how the technology worked and what it was possible to do and what it might be possible to do 5 years from now, because things were changing so quickly. So that's the kind of that's the way the course started. So I started teaching a course on a general education course at Harvard not for future computer scientists, although we've drawn some people into the field through it, but for people who are English majors and history majors, people who are going to be lawyers and doctors and, you know, and whatever. And as I was planning the course, I ran into Hal, who I've known for a long time, because we're about the same age. We've both been in the field just down the street from each other at Harvard and MIT. And he got interested, and Hal, in his typically generous way, say, "Oh, would you like me to help you teach that?" And I said, "Well, I'm not going to turn that offer down." So the two of us started teaching this course together at Harvard, both in the college and as a distance education course, where it's actually being offered this year as a distance education course in both the fall and spring this year. And then I pulled Ken into it because Ken, CEO of Nevo Technologies, I thought would make the ideal teaching assistant for the course. So Ken assumed his role as helper. So that's after we'd been teaching the course for a couple of years, you know, our level of ambition just went up, and we just said, you know, this is not a, yeah, sure, it's something that every student graduating from college should understand, but
there's a much larger group of people who need to understand it, like people who are going to vote, which is everybody, and people who are going to be involved in any kind of commercial transaction on either side of the counter need to understand what happened to this, and so on. So the three of us got together and decided that we needed to put out a book that was for everyone to read.
Now, you've talked about the course, Hal, go ahead.
Well, let's see. So just to give a little bit more background, I've been teaching a much more technical version of a course like this at MIT since about 1994. And what struck me, now I'm still teaching that course, what struck me is how much the discourse has changed. So the title of our course at MIT, which I made in 1994, is Ethics and Law on the Electronic Frontier. And just the whole idea that the internet and all this stuff was a frontier is something that sounds remarkably quaint. And if anything, it's completely the opposite. Rather than what we used to call in the old days cyberspace, rather than being a place that's out there, what's happened is the bits revolution is coming through and just transforming everything about the way we live. And so the opportunity to do this with Harry at Harvard and do a much more broad appeal version of the course was something that I thought was tremendous, and then to get even broader through the book, that's just been an enormous pleasure rethinking all of this.
And David, just to add my own perspective,
please.
What was so really wonderful about this entire process is, as Harry mentioned, this is not in any way, shape, or form directed towards technologists. It's directed towards responsible citizens. It's directed towards people who have authority and responsibility, whether they are buying something or selling something, or most importantly, voting. I think we were all encouraged or moved along in this mission when we saw Senator Ted Stevens say on the floor of the Senate that the internet is not a truck, it's a series of tubes, and we thought, well, gee, you know, people really have to have a deeper understanding of these things. They have to understand how their privacy is affected, and do they care whether the stuff that you see on Google is what really exists or what Google is showing you, whether how the pieces that interact and connect us all together alter our lives, because they affect every single aspect of the world in which we live.
You raise an interesting point, and I think it's worth discussing. We're recording the show on September 5th, and so we're recording it just at the end of the Republican National Convention. And I think I'll ask you, since that now infamous remark by Senator Stevens, do you have a sense of, based upon writing this book as well, do you think the public has more knowledge of technology than it did even at that point? How pervasive do you think technology issues are to the average citizen who isn't immersed in technology but uses it as a consumer?
Oh, I would say I think the issue is a pervasive issue, and the understanding is extraordinarily limited. You can see this even in the positions the candidates take, but speaking just as individuals, it is quite remarkable how little understanding most people have.
And I think what's increasing is parties with vested interests of one kind or another helpfully trying to explain to you how it is in a way that just happens to leave out pieces of the picture or is distorted in a way that serves their own interests. So, there's an increasing number of explanations. If you go, listen to your internet service provider, your cable TV company or something, and they will explain to you why they have to do things certain ways and not other ways. But people need to get a sort of more neutral and less commercial version of an explanation of all of this, and that's really what we aimed to do here.
Let's talk.
And what you see is one of the themes in the book underlying it, and certainly for us when we wrote it, is the use and misuse of metaphors to understand what's going on, and what's happening is people are hearing more and more of these metaphors, and connect to them in various ways, and they're all misleading in ways. So one of the ones we talk about in the book a lot is this notion of the spectrum as property, as if it were land. I mean, that's something that has been made totally obsolete by spread spectrum. And yet you still see these arguments about property and allocation going before the FCC, going before Congress, the way people talk about that. And that's just one tiny example of sort of misuse of metaphors that this whole area is riddled with when you try to convince other people to adopt your position.
Gentlemen, I think
These are often things that really affect people in very, very practical ways. And if we can get them to understand that a level of understanding that goes one level past the metaphor, these metaphors are extraordinarily important and extraordinarily useful. As technologists, we use them all the time, but you have to bring a slightly deeper level of understanding, and we try to make this book completely accessible through stories and examples and tales that people can relate to very, very directly so that they can understand what's really going on. The very first story in the book, the story about Tanya Ryder, is a really touching tale, and we can relate it more if you'd like, but it was there to get people to understand that if you carry your cell phone around in your pocket, we know where you are, and because bits are so small and so cheap, we can keep that information forever. So if we want to say, where was David Levine on September 5th at 10 o'clock in the morning, the phone company knows.
It raises, and it moves us into a deeper discussion of the book, and what I always ask authors is, of course, the title. What do you mean by the title, Blown to Bits?
Well, there's a double meaning to it. Talk about, you know, metaphors that are powerful and suggestive. On the one hand, there is this image that there's this virtual world, this world of zeros and ones that is now everywhere. I mean, you can an iPod is big enough to hold, you know, a map of the entire Earth down to a very fine degree of resolution. That was just an unimaginable change in the capacity of information to be preserved and distributed and communicated. And what's happened in the last, decade or two is that the inexorable growth in computer speed, processor speed, communication speed, and storage capacity have, you know, blown through some barriers that used to make it impossible to do things. So now everything can be recorded, everything can be saved, everybody can have everything in principle. And the technology is no longer the barrier to remembering every word that your child says from the day they're born until the day they die. That didn't used to be possible with any previous generation. But now the technology doesn't lie in the way. We have to decide as a social matter whether that's something that is worth doing or not. So the explosion is just this sense of enormous growth in information processing capacity and information storage capacity. The other meaning of the explosion, the blown to bits, is that change has really shaken up many of our social expectations and social conventions about what ownership means, to take the example Hal just mentioned, what privacy means, how we make our friends, how do we learn to trust the people that we deal with. You know, do you trust the mail more than you trust, you know, the electronic communications? All sorts of things about the way we lead our lives. You know, do you read books anymore, and so on, that are just things that are part of everyday life. That's why we kind of begin the book with on the privacy issue, because that's the one where we're most shaken up. It's not necessarily that privacy has been destroyed, although part of the explosive metaphor there might well lead you to think that. But what's been destroyed is our whole notion, or the whole notion, and certainly among the younger generation, of what privacy is and why it's important and whether it's even a relevant thing to worry about anymore. So many people are much more interested in connectedness than they are in privacy, and are quite happily giving up things that we used to think were important in terms of privacy rights. So there's an explosion of kind of social expectations, social conventions, and social practices that has gone along with the technological explosion.
The authors are Hal Abelson, Ken Ledeen, and Harry Lewis, authors of the book Blown to Bits, Your Life, Liberty, and Happiness After the Digital Explosion, in conversation on Hearsay Culture. Gentlemen, let's dive in. We have about 7 minutes or so before we take a very short break. And I do want to ask you, and you started getting into it just now, in the subjects that you decided to cover in the book, how did you go about picking them? It sounds like it was based upon ultimately what you think the public needs to know about. And I'm curious to know if there are any topics that you would have liked to have gotten into but perhaps didn't, or anything that you think, were you to write this book a few years from now, you'd have to add.
Al?
Well, I'm just trying to think. I think we cover a lot of the beginnings of stuff, but things are going to change so much over the next couple of years. One of the things that we don't talk about much at all is the international landscape, because of course the other thing that's happening is that because of the internet and the web, the sort of sovereignty of governments in various ways is being challenged, and that's sort of an enormous area. We didn't go into that much in the book at all. We took a very U.S. centric view, mainly because we wanted to comment on the social changes, and to go beyond U.S. society and U.S. attitudes would have been a much, much larger enterprise. But I think if we were going to write this book 5 years from now, we would definitely be talking about internationalism and international culture.
Let me give a thought here. I actually think we're writing this moment at a critical moment in time,
mm-hmm.
and that in some sense the book might be irrelevant 5 years from now, because so many of the issues over which I believe people, at least free people, have a say today, or potentially could have a say today, are going to be settled 5 years from now. And the status of who knows what about whom, what kind of information is available, what sort of things you're going to be able to say using electronic media. Watching the Olympics take place in China and the struggle that's going on there, that went on there, it's over now, over what exactly it meant when the Chinese government promised the International Olympic Committee that the visiting press would have freedom to say what they wanted to say and to, access the information they wanted to access, which turned out to be, rather in dispute when the events actually took place because of various forms of electronic and other forms of control that were exercised. The next Olympics, probably, that will all have been settled one way or another, and maybe not the way we hope it will be settled, but there's so much of this stuff that's actually up in the air right now. Hal mentioned the example of the restructuring of the radio spectrum and the opportunities that are there for vastly more efficient use of the radio and television, to the point where we could have as much radio and television broadcasting going on as there are books being printed. It's no longer, even just hundreds of channels that are possible. But a lot of this depends on decisions that are being made by governments, by corporations, and by individuals that probably are going to be, in a different place. They'll be in a different stage of their evolution in 5 years from now. Some of the important issues may, in fact, be settled. So we wanted to write the book at a moment where we had some opportunity to wake people up to what's
happening and what kinds of decisions are happening, and before the decisions all get made while we were happily just, you know, kind of enjoying our iPods rather than, you know, being aware of some of the decisions that were being made on how we were might be able to use them in the future.
David, I wanted mm-hmm. to just add one small cautionary note.
Please.
To Harry's statement. It certainly feels like, particularly on the legal front, we're right at this precedent-setting moment where we're going to figure out how these things work, and then in the future we'll just be in a world of refinement. The one caution I wanted to add is that the world of information technology and the digital explosion has moved at an exponential pace since its early beginnings. And wherever you are on that curve, it feels like the curve is flat. It feels like, okay, well, we saw these huge changes, but now things are kind of stable and they're just moving along and we've seen the big changes. Well, now we have Google and we have this and we have that, and all right, now we know what the landscape's going to be like. But that isn't the case. I mean, the cautionary word is that we're still on this exponential curve, and 10 years from now, computers are likely to be 1,000 times bigger and faster, and so we have to recognize that there are still enormous, enormous changes in front of us. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of examples of people who were making decisions because they looked at how things were and assumed that's the way things were going to be. And yet, things progressed so much and so rapidly that assumption was proven false. We use the example all the time of Kodak thinking that digital cameras would never really be good enough to take decent pictures and missing that whole boat. Or Ken Olson, the founder of Digital Equipment Corporation, thinking that computers never could really be small enough and fast enough for individuals to want them or have them.
You bring up DEC, and I think after the break, I want to talk a little bit about that history and the values that we find in technology. We're talking to the authors of Blown to Bits, Your Life, Liberty, and Happiness After the Digital Explosion, the authors of Hal Abelson, Ken Ledeen, and Harry Lewis, here on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, and for those of you that don't, you know what I'm about to do. KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. If you are interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. You can also go to kzsu.stanford.edu, the station's website, and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless of whether you make a donation, and I sincerely hope you do, please continue to listen to KZSU. Please continue to listen to Hearsay Culture, and hopefully you'll continue to enjoy our diverse programming. So, gentlemen, let's dive into some of the specifics of the book. And as you begin the book, you discuss various values or basic principles of the internet and technology that you think people should be aware of. Now, I'm going to allow you to both pronounce and define the term that you use, and perhaps you could talk a little bit about what values you believe the internet should encompass and whether any of those values are inalienable.
Well, we begin with a list of things which are not really values. We call them koans.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's just a rather flippant pun on the notion of a Zen Buddhist sort of pronouncement or principle, but these are kind of internally paradoxical principles about bits, about the digital world. You know, for example, one of them is perfection is normal. Perfection is normal means that copies are always perfect, and that this is, in fact, true of digital copies, or it's so true that what the real truth is not that digital perfect copies are necessarily perfect, but that if you do things right, you know, you can be more confident that that you're making a perfect copy of something than you can be that the sun will rise tomorrow, which, you know, it may not be. We could get hit by an asteroid or something. There are always some possibilities, and there are always some possibilities of a bit getting lost. But with
with sufficient coding expertise, which we don't explain how that's done, but you have this thing that's never existed before since the dawn of time, when people started writing scratches on cave walls. And through the enormous social revolution that was caused by the printing press, that we've now got a technology that makes it possible to have absolutely perfect copies. And we don't posit that as a good thing or a bad thing in and of itself. It just is, and it has huge consequences, as legal scholars and lawyers who work in the intellectual property area, for example, and in copyright law, are well aware. So we then, in a later chapter, we go and talk about the consequences of that for copyright law. So we go through a bunch of these, you know, of these koans. You know, one I think that goes with the story Ken just noted about Kodak missing the boat, and by the way, Bill Gates almost missed the internet boat in exactly the same way. It wasn't until very late in the game that he suddenly realized that internet connectivity was going to completely change Microsoft's business, because people would no longer be bound to, you know, put a check in the mail and have somebody mail a CD so they could load the software onto their computer anymore. That's not the way computers would be in a completely networked world.
Right.
So this koan is more of the same, can be a whole new thing. We hear all of the time, you know, people say, gee, isn't it great that your computer, you know, is, you know, you can get a computer that's twice as fast as the one you bought, you know, a couple of years ago, and it costs the same amount of money. But when things get faster, sometimes they actually make it possible to do things that are qualitatively different than were possible before. And, you know, the digital camera example is just a great example of that. Way back in the 80s, it was possible to do digital photography, but you couldn't do it in a camera that you could sell in Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't do it with a chip in it that would enable you to hold, you know, thousands of photographs. So there was a moment there between the 80s and, you know, the year 2000 or so, where some threshold was crossed as a result of steady progress. So we have seven of these koans that are sort of have somewhat mysterious and paradoxical properties to them. Describe somewhat paradoxical properties of the digital world that have to do with the fact that bits cost essentially nothing. They take essentially no physical space to store. They can be moved around essentially instantly. And those are very strange things for those of us who have grown up kind of in the physical world, as we all have. Hal, you want to take on the values question?
I was going to say the other one that Ken already alluded to is nothing goes away.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a consequence of vast amounts of digital storage that we haven't really grappled with yet. We don't know how to think about it. Our intuitions aren't there yet. I mean, do you mind? Now, is it fine with you when you go into a store, your image is recorded on a department store camera? Well, of course, who cares? You know, maybe there's nobody looking at it, or they hire people to do it, or they'll erase the tapes or something. But we haven't grappled with the idea that that stuff now becomes bits that can be digitally mined forever, can be combined with other things in a database, and someone someday can search and say, tell me everything about where Ken Ledeen was in September 2008, and it'll find this image along with a whole bunch of other images. We don't know how to think about that. We don't know how to think about the fact that it's not only that there are lots of bits, but that they're being stored and data mined someplace. And again, you know, one of the values we say is that technology is neither good or bad. But technology is something that people have to understand. When you have such enormous changes and things make such an enormous difference. God, I have a friend who has a brother-in-law in Sacramento who's just been cited by the town council there for having his swimming pool in a messy state. Now, how do they know that? Well, they're just sitting and looking at the Google Earth photographs of swimming pools in Sacramento.
Right.
We're not used to the idea that somebody can go around and just do that, that we're exposed so much and that this information is around. So again, you can argue whether that's good or bad, whether that's a horrible violation of privacy or whether that's a tremendous, wonderful thing for sanitation in the city. But the main thing that people need to do is to recognize that that ability exists.
And it reminds me, of course, when we discuss intellectual property issues or you discuss criminal law issues, you have issues of flyovers and peering into people's windows and whether that's a privacy issue and whether it gives law enforcement certain rights. And, of course, now we're talking about having that technology be ubiquitous, which leads me to one point that runs through your book. The control of information, which you've alluded to already a few times, here runs through your book. The idea of little brother is watching, search queries being released by America Online, track changes in Word documents that allows individuals to see what changes have been made. Oftentimes, as you cite in the book, with some pretty stark examples where the authors didn't intend that information to be accessible to others. And you connect this up with privacy. And one of the areas you discuss that I think is always interesting is the prevalence of personal spy software. This software that you can install on your computer to find out if your spouse is doing something or any other uses, but that's perhaps the most well-known use of the technology. How does the idea and the existence of personal spy software fit into your conception of technology broadly, this idea of control of information but not having complete control?
Well, first of all, it is illegal, so I think it's important to point out that installing software surreptitiously on your spouse's computer to monitor what they do with their email is not a legal thing to do.
Right.
I think I would defer to Hal to comment on that a little bit more. But so we certainly aren't commenting on that particular type of behavior. But you do see all sorts of things that are particularly overt, like having the Easy Pass or Fast Lane transponder in your car, that, as Hal was pointing about things being neither good nor bad, allows you to save time as you travel, but also gives the divorce lawyer the opportunity to say where you were and at what time.
You know, I think the spy software thing is certainly, an interesting example, because, you know, even though it's not legal, people do it, and I'm not actually sure which laws make it illegal and where, but on the general point that you say about control of information and privacy, one of the points that we make, connecting it to the Hal's last remark, is that there are lots of technologies now out there which, if the police had them, we would think were horrifying. But because the police and your teenage daughter and all of her friends and your mother-in-law and everybody else has them, we just kind of take as normal. You know, imagine police sitting on buses and streetcars with cameras photographing people. You know, guy there in uniform or plainclothesman or something like that, you know, and you discovered that police were shooting photographs of people on the bus. You know, in America, I mean, in China, you know, maybe everybody would say what's new, but in America, we would think that would be horrible. But, of course, every teenager's got their cell phone camera. They're constantly snapping pictures of people on buses and so on and posting them on YouTube and, you know, putting them on Flickr and sharing them around and so on. So this is a great example of the sort of thing that, as Hal said, we just don't know. We really don't know how to think about it. In some ways, we think it's horrible. In some ways, it's plainly wonderful. If you see an assault taking place, it's harder to assault someone on a bus now than it used to be, because very likely somebody's going to whip out their cell phone camera and take a picture of the assailant.
Right.
So it's certainly not automatically bad, and, you know, there's lots of fun quality to it and so on. But it's a very exposed, very, very, very different notion of what kind of exposed lives we all lead because these technologies, whether they're desktop software on personal computers or cell phone cameras everywhere, they're as the technically what would say, there are now small, cheap sensors gathering all kinds of information everywhere. That's the other part. You know, we talked about earlier the capacity to move and store vast numbers of bits easily and cheaply, but the other part of it is there are these devices of various kinds for gathering information, many of which people don't even know about. I mean, we talk about the examples of the black boxes that exist in automobiles now that will record accident data the way they used to record, I mean, the way we're used to accident data being recorded for airplanes. Well, you know, your insurance company is going to get a very accurate record if you have a new car,
right,
of exactly how fast you were going, whether your foot was on the brake and everything else, because that stuff is all now digitally recorded in your car in a way that it didn't used to be. So that it's the pervasiveness of the of these technologies. Sometimes we're not only aware of it, but we're the agents, the active agents of it, as in the cell phone camera example. Sometimes people put it in and they don't really tell us about it, or we just pay no attention to it because it's a federal law in this case, and we, you know, if you want to buy a car, you've got to buy the digital recording that goes with it. This has put all kinds of things are up in the air about how we, you know, how we view our control over our lives as a result of these various trends.
And just maybe add just one more little wrinkle here that we do talk about. There's an enormous difference between information that's available and information that's accessible. There's all sorts of information that was publicly available but inaccessible, and now you can just get at it. We give lots of examples of that. We also have the ability to connect up dots in ways that transform the entire experience. So just because of where we are at this point in time, Federal Elections Commission data has been available ever since they started collecting it, but now you can go online and put in your address and see exactly to whom and how much money was given by all of your neighbors on a map, and click on it and drill down, and it changes your whole feeling about how exposed you are and what's going on, because information is available, is accessible that was previously available, and because dots can be connected up, we can start to tie pieces together because it's all digital.
We're talking to.
I think that's the critical difference about the dots being connected up that people still quite haven't appreciated. So it's not merely that there a bunch of people are uploading pictures of other people from their cell phone cameras. It's that that stuff now can be data mined and searched and aggregated, and you can infer all sorts of things just from searching the corpus of things that people are putting up there casually right now. And we still don't quite know how to cope with that. I was thinking when you're talking about spyware, you know, spyware may be even unnecessary in a couple of years because everyone will be doing things online and all that stuff will be in the cloud, and it can be searched by God knows how. You won't even have control over that. You won't even know. You won't even have to bother doing something with your spouse's computer. You could have your divorce lawyer go subpoena AOL or something.
The authors are Hal Abelson.
This is a tremendously important point just to introduce into the conversation, because there's so much interest now in cloud computing. There's interest in moving data off of our personal machines back to something else. And Hal mentioned that wonderful notion back from the 60s of time sharing. This is just time sharing for the 21st century. We're all using that computer that's over there someplace. And David, when you raise the question of who controls the information, when information is stored on my laptop or my iPod, I decide how access is granted, I decide how our subpoena is responded to, all of these sorts of things. When the information is stored at Google or at Yahoo or at IBM, all of a sudden that power is shifted, that control is shifted to a third party that may have completely different interests.
The authors are Hal Abelson, Ken Ledeen, and Harry Lewis, authors of the book Blown to Bits. Gentlemen, we have about 10 minutes left, and of course we can, you know, it's tip of the iceberg stuff even for an hour-long radio show. And so I do want to kind of ask you a broad question. You know, we see technology obviously is pervasive. We know this, and your table of contents covers so many different issues that touch on how technology impacts people in ways both known and unknown. And I guess I'll ask you, the question this way. When we look at situations, we see famous situations involving Yahoo and Google, where you have companies that are both extremely innovative and have brought wonderful new technologies, and search is just one, that companies like Google and Yahoo have brought that have allowed people access to information. In fact, search and search engines really are the portal now at this point for virtually everyone, and certainly most people, to get information on the internet. We see these wonderful developments at the same time with regard to control. We also see some collusion. We see collusion most prominently with Chinese authorities with respect to search results on certain terms, and issues of censorship. And I'm wondering, again, from the perspective of the consumers, the people to whom you're writing this book, as you mentioned, the people that are voting and thinking about these issues during a political season, how concerned should we be about the internet's future as a medium where one can find accurate and truthful information if you look hard enough?
This is a sorting out process. This is a sorting out process, this is one of those situations where we're at a little bit of a point of discontinuity, because the vast amounts of information have been made available online. There are no official arbiters of which of it is truthful and which of it is not. And, again, in the United States of America, there were never official arbiters of what was true and what wasn't, but there were things like the New York Times that people used to more or less assume, whatever they thought of their editorial opinions, they used to think the kind of news reporting was tolerably accurate. But so to the extent that we all get our daily dose of information, let's just restrict ourselves to news, just to try to be specific, because it's such a big topic that you've raised. The internet has made it simultaneously possible to find out what happened yesterday in small African countries that you never would have merited news coverage in the New York Times. And if you rely on, bloggers in Asia and Africa and South America, you can get an even larger amount of information. But there's no longer anything that corresponds to, the editorial board or the managing editor of the daily newspapers that had, standards of journalistic objectivity and, not printing things until there were multiple sources to back them up and so on. So I think we're going through a sorting out process, and what we wanted to do in the book is to educate people. So we spent a whole chapter on search, for example, that explains more or less roughly, not exactly because we don't know exactly, but roughly how a search engine such as Google or Yahoo or any of the other minor players in the business, how they rank order their results, and what you can trust and what you shouldn't trust as far as whether information got where it is on the screen in front of you as a result of a transfer of funds. And there's some good news and there's some just things that people that people should understand. And this is another area in which there is a continuing evolution going on, and where people need to be educated about how to assess the quality of information they see based on checking multiple sources themselves, and, you know, how do they develop confidence in the reliability of the sources that they're reading, and so on. I think we've already passed the stage, because it's been I've seen enough cartoons to the contrary, where people know that if you just go search for something and the first thing that comes up, you know, that you can assume that it must be true. So I think I think most people are at least that aware. Although I'm sometimes reading student papers, you wonder that there has to be some kind of quality check. But this is very much a matter that's still being sorted out.
Yeah. David, let me answer your question very, very specifically. You said how much should we be concerned, and I think we should be very concerned, but not paranoid about this. And we hoped with this book both to educate and to entertain, and I think this book, it turns out to be a very entertaining book as well. But even at the simplest level, search is the way we, so many of us, find information, but many, many people don't recognize that if you search for the same thing on Google and Yahoo, you're likely to get very different results.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some very simple things people can do to be responsible in this area. So you should be concerned, but it's wonderful, wonderful stuff. And we think the readers of the book will have a blast reading it, as well as learning some important stuff.
Well, I certainly enjoyed reading the book. And in fact, since we only have a few minutes left now, I do want to say that I, as you know, I have a list of questions, and so I sincerely invite you back in the very near future to continue the discussion, because there's so many other areas that we can get into, and I think your book together brings together quite a bit of information, both from a technical standpoint as well as from a policy standpoint, that I would very much enjoy continuing the discussion with you. For those that want to learn more about your work, obviously we have your book, Blown to Bits, Your Life, Liberty, and Happiness After the Digital Explosion, but where else can they find more information?
We have a site. The website is called bitsbook.com. Just go there. We blog pretty much daily. We've got some press reviews posted there. They can find out what other people have to say, good and bad, about what we've written, and that's the place to go. And please join the discussion that's there. Bitsbook.com, BITSBOOK.COM.
Gentlemen, is it possible to audit your course? Because I think I'd like to take it. So I think, if there's a way.
There actually is an audit status. So I don't know when this show is being run, but
late September
15th, Ken and I will be teaching the first class, paralleling the book. It meets once a week. You can do it, take it live feed or on tape delay. It's called Computer Science, what is it? E2A, I think it's called. Life, Liberty, and Happiness After the Digital Explosion, in the Harvard School of Continuing Education.
Well, I think I'm going to have to look that up, because, like I said, I find the area fascinating, and I really enjoyed your book. Gentlemen, Hal Abelson.
Glad to have you there.
Well, thank you, and I look forward to it. Hal Abelson, Ken Ledeen, Harry Lewis, authors of the book Blown to Bits, Your Life, Liberty, and Happiness After the Digital Explosion, published by Addison Wesley. Thank you so much for joining us and benefiting my listeners here on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
Yes, it was fun.
I enjoyed it. So we have a number of shows coming up in this fall quarter. The show is being recorded on September 5th and will air in late September. And down the road, as you look down the schedule, you're going to see that we have a variety of guests on. Clay Shirky, author of the book Here Comes Everybody. Professor Paul Ohm of University of Colorado Boulder, discussing computers and the law broadly, and more specifically some of the copyright issues as well. We also will have on David Rice, author of Geekonomics, Mark Barrowline, author of The Dumbest Generation, Andrew Luman, and Wendy Seltzer, discussing the Tor Project, speaking of control of information, a very interesting project dealing with how anonymity can be maintained in technology generally. David Levine, no relation because we are everywhere, but David Levine and Michelle Boldrin, author of the book Against Intellectual Monopoly, taking a very strong stance against the operations of the patent system, as well as Morel Hildebrandt, And Serge Gutworth, authors, co-editors, actually, of the book Profiling a European Citizen. Nick Carr, author of the book The Big Switch, Rewiring the World from Edison to Google. And I continue to book other guests as well. And very excited to continue to book fascinating guests like those that we just had on the show. For those of you that are listening to the show live on KZSU, that's great. I certainly encourage you to do that. The show is on Wednesdays at 5 p.m. Pacific. But you can also get the show through iTunes, through the Center for Internet Society's podcast page, through iTunes. You can also get the show through the RSS feed at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, which is CIS's, the Center for Internet Society's webpage. And you can, of course, always get all information about the show, scheduling, and previous shows by going to hearsayculture.com. Also, as always, I welcome your feedback, comments, suggestions on guests by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. And otherwise, I just thank you for listening today. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation. And please stay tuned to KZSU for further diverse programming. Have a great evening.